operations have grown so great that the state of Arizona was powerless to interfere. They have been shielded, as you know, by the geographic circumstances of Arizona's northernmost territory, the region beyond the Grand Canyon that is best known as the Strip. This is a land of high plateaus, dense forests, great breaks and gorges, rolling arid lands, and intense color, a land squeezed between the even higher plateaus of Utah and the Grand Canyon of Arizona. The community of Short Creek is 400 miles by the shortest road from the Mojave County seat of Kingman. Massive cliffs rearing north of Short Creek's little central street provide a natural rock barrier to the north. To the east and west are the sweeping expanses of dry and almost barren plateaus before the forests begin. To the south, there is the Grand Canyon. It is in this most isolated of all Arizona communities that this foulest of conspiracies has flourished and expanded in a terrifying geometric progression. Here has been a community entirely dedicated to the warped philosophy that a small handful of greedy and licentious men should have the right and the power to control the destiny of every human soul in the community. Here is a community, many of the women, sadly, right along with the men, unalterably dedicated to the wicked theory that every maturing girl child should be forced into the bondage of multiple wifehood with men of all ages for the sole purpose of producing more children to be reared to become more chattels of this totally lawless enterprise. One day after the raid, the Deseret News, a daily newspaper owned by the LDS Church, editorialized in support of the action. Utah and Arizona owe a debt of gratitude to Arizona's Howard Pyle. We hope the unfortunate activities at Short Creek will be cleaned up once and for all. The raid made national headlines. It was even reported on the front page of the New York Times, with the same prominence given to a story announcing the armistice ending the Korean War. But to the dismay of the LDS leadership, most of the press presented the polygamists in a favorable light. Photographs of crying children being torn from their mother's arms generated sympathy throughout the nation for the fundamentalists, who protested that they were upstanding, law-abiding Mormons simply trying to exercise their constitutionally protected freedoms. The raid was widely perceived as religious persecution by overly zealous government agencies, and it sparked a great outcry in support of the polygamists. The Arizona Republic, for example, criticized the action as a misuse of public funds. In 1954, Governor Pyle was voted out of office, thanks largely to the raid and the egg it left on his face. The arrests and subsequent trials cost taxpayers $600,000, yet by 1956, all the polygamists who had been arrested were out of jail and reunited with their families in Short Creek. Members of the UEP unapologetically resumed living the principle as taught by Joseph Smith, and the population of the town continued to more than double each decade, a consequence of the community's giant families and astronomical birth rate. Paradoxically, the Short Creek raid proved to be a huge boon to the FLDS Church. Thanks to the backlash that followed the raid, for most of the next half century, fundamentalists were able to practice polygamy throughout the Intermountain West with little state interference. Until May 1998, when a battered and bruised teenage girl dialed 911 from a payphone at a truck stop in northern Utah. The girl reported to the police that immediately after her 16th birthday, her father, a businessman named John Kingston, had pulled her out of high school and forced her to become the 15th wife of his brother, David Kingston, the girl's 32-year-old uncle. Both Kingston brothers are among 1,500 members of the so-called Kingston Clan, a Mormon fundamentalist sect based in Salt Lake County, officially known as the Latter-day Church of Christ, led by Patriarch Paul Kingston, a lawyer who was married to at least 25 women and has sired some 200 offspring. Twice the girl tried to run away from David, but she was caught each time. After the second escape, she sought refuge with her mother, who promptly turned the girl over to her father. John Kingston then drove her to a remote ranch near the Utah-Idaho border that the Kingstons used as a re-education camp for wayward wives and disobedient children. He took the girl into a barn, pulled his belt off, and used it to whip her savagely across the buttocks, thighs, and lower back, inflicting hideous injuries. The girl later told a judge that before the beating began, her father warned her that he was going to give me 10 licks for every wrongdoing. After whipping his daughter, John Kingston departed, at which point the girl fled from the ranch and limped 5 miles along a dirt road until she reached a gas station where she called the police. Both John and David Kingston were arrested and subsequently convicted in highly publicized trials. John was found guilty of child abuse and locked up in the county jail for 28 weeks. David was sentenced to 10 years in prison for incest and unlawful sexual conduct. And Mormon fundamentalists all over the West immediately found themselves uncomfortably back in the public eye. But if the Kingston convictions made the fundamentalists in Colorado City edgy, they became considerably more nervous in April 2000 when another Utah polygamist, Thomas Arthur Green, was charged with bigamy and first-degree felony rape of a child. The Kingston trial, although front-page news in Utah, didn't make a big splash elsewhere. The state's prosecution of Green turned into a public spectacle, largely of Green's own creation, and his plural marriages were featured in every major media outlet from Seattle to Miami. 54-year-old Tom Green is a fat, bearded man with a receding hairline, 32 children, and 5 wives. He has married at least 10 different women all told, but the other 5 have left him. The oldest of his current wives is 22 years younger than he is. The youngest is 29 years younger. Home for the gigantic Green family has long been a collection of decrepit trailers plunked down on 10 acres of desert in Juab County's desolate Snake Valley, way out toward the Nevada line, 100 miles from the nearest paved road. Green has modestly christened this little kingdom Greenhaven. Unlike most polygamists who conscientiously avoid outside scrutiny, Green has an insatiable thirst for publicity. He and his wives have opened their lives to numerous print journalists and have eagerly appeared on such television shows as Judge Judy, Jerry Springer, Queen Latifah, Sally Jesse Raphael, and Dateline NBC. They decided to seek this media attention, Green explained in a public statement, after he woke up one morning and heard a voice say to me, "Don't hide your light under a bushel, but let your light so shine before men so that they will see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." I told my wives what I had heard and that I understood from it that God wanted us to be an example that plural marriage can work. We are not ashamed of our beliefs, and we are certainly not ashamed of our family. We just want people to realize that polygamists are not a threat. We are not fanatics. We are not criminals. Unfortunately for Tom Green, Juab County Attorney David O. Levitt, the younger brother of Utah Governor Mike Levitt, happened to turn on his television one night in 1999 to see Green boasting of his young wives on Dateline NBC. Although Levitt had long known about Green's polygamous colony out in the West Desert, until he saw Green holding forth in prime time, he'd had no intention of prosecuting him. As a child, Levitt had had friends who were the offspring of polygamists, and his own great-grandfather had married a plurality of wives. In 1993, when Levitt was fresh out of law school and working as a public defender, he'd even defended a polygamist, and won, by arguing that the religious freedom guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution overruled state laws criminalizing plural marriage. But then Levitt saw Green bragging on national television that he had married all of his current wives when they were mere girls. One of them was only 13 when he, at age 37, got her pregnant. According to Utah statute, when an adult male has sex with a 13-year-old child, a first-degree felony has been committed. Tom Green, at first blush, appeared to be someone that no one should bother, Levitt explained to reporter Pauline Arriaga of the Associated Press in November 2000. But this is a man who has taken 13 and 14-year-old children, deprived them of any education, married them, impregnated them, required the state to pay the bill, and has raped a 13-year-old girl. 5 months after the Dateline show aired, Levitt filed charges against Green, who was supporting his oversized family by drawing welfare checks. Investigators from the Utah Attorney General's office have documented that between 1989 and 1999, Tom Green and his dependents received more than $647,000 in state and federal assistance, including $203,000 in food stamps and nearly $300,000 in medical and dental expenses. These same investigators estimate that had they been granted complete access to pertinent government files as far back as 1985, when Green began his polygamous lifestyle, they would have been able to show that Green received well over $1 million in welfare. Linda Coons Green, now 28, was 13 when she married Tom Green. She insists that she has done nothing wrong, that she is no victim. She says that she enjoys being a plural wife and points out that getting married to Green was her idea. Levitt counters that Linda is simply a victim of what psychologists call the Stockholm syndrome, in which hostages sympathize with and later defend their captors. The ability to choose is an ability that Linda Green never had, Levitt argues. At the time Linda Coons married Green, her mother, Beth Cook, was also married to Green, although Cook has since left him. 7 of the 10 women Green has married, and all of his current wives, were the children of his other wives when he married them. He has made a habit of marrying his stepdaughters, all of whom were 16 or younger when he brought them into his matrimonial bed. Cook was raised in Short Creek, the product of a polygamous family. In 1953, when she was 9 years old, she watched Mojave County Sheriff's deputies arrest her father and 30 other men in the Short Creek raid. 3 years later, at the age of 12, Cook was married off to her stepfather, Warren Elmer Johnson, the brother of Prophet Leroy Johnson. Cook became one of 7 women married to Elmer. In 1984, after Elmer Johnson had died and the husband who succeeded him had departed, Cook and her 2 daughters were introduced to Green at a Sunday school meeting. "I paid particular attention to him," Cook told freelance journalist Carolyn Campbell, "because my friend said she had met Tom Green and he was the ugliest man she had ever met." Cook, who is 4 years older than Green, thought otherwise. She found him handsome, as well as highly intelligent. She was impressed with the way he took charge of the meeting. He asked her out on a date, during which he announced that he was going to marry her, a prophecy that was fulfilled in short order. The newlyweds honeymooned in Bountiful, Canada, a colony of UEP polygamists in southeastern British Columbia. By 1985, Cook couldn't help noticing that her 13-year-old daughter, Linda Coons, was showing feelings toward Green. Linda liked to sit in her stepfather's lap and would hang on to him for the longest time. She talked about him constantly and eventually asked Cook if she could marry Green. Cook consented, and in January 1986, Linda married Tom Green in Los Molinos, Mexico, a polygamous outpost on the Baja Peninsula. "I was happy for my daughter because she was happy and it was what she wanted," Cook said afterward. "I was happy to share her with a man I loved very dearly and thought was a very special person." Linda Coons Green was pregnant with Green's child before her 14th birthday. Even though Beth Cook left Green, she defends her daughter's marriage to him. 15 years later, she said in a 2001 interview with journalist Campbell, "I feel that time has proven it was a good decision. They are prosecuting Tom based on 19th century morals. Now who cares who sleeps with who? They are all consenting adults. Right now there are lesbians, homosexuals, and single people living together all the time. There are married people living with others who they are not married to." David Levitt doesn't consider Green's plural marriages a matter of religious freedom or a harmless sexual relationship between consenting adults. Levitt views Green as a pedophile, plain and simple. "He preyed on little girls who from the cradle knew no other life but polygamy," Levitt told Holly Mullen, a reporter from the Salt Lake Tribune, in August 2002. "He robbed them of their childhood. When I looked at this picture, I realized it was about 5 women, all of them given in marriage by their mothers, all of them raised by their fathers to marry as children. They are victims of pedophiles, and they are victims of the state of Utah, which turned its back on polygamy for 60 years. Levitt's case proved convincing in court. In August 2001, Green was convicted of 4 counts of bigamy and 1 charge of criminal non-support of his family. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison and ordered to pay $78,868 in restitution. A year later, Levitt put Green on trial again for the additional and considerably more serious charge of having sex with Linda Coons when she was 13, a crime that could have put him in prison for life. This time around, however, Green got lucky. Although he was found guilty of first-degree felony child rape, the judge gave him the minimum sentence, 5 years to life, to be served concurrently with his previous 5-year sentence for bigamy. The relatively soft punishment riled many Utahns. 2 days after Green was sentenced, an editorial in the Spectrum, the daily paper of St. George, Utah, an LDS stronghold less than 40 miles from Colorado City, opined, "Taxpayers, and most importantly, children lost during Tuesday's sentencing hearing for now infamous polygamist Tom Green. In some polygamist relationships, particularly those involving young girls, there is a bit of brainwashing that goes on both before and after the illegal marriages. Girls are led to believe that such a relationship is one way to salvation. Then they typically are taken as wives by men twice their ages. Without the context of spiritual marriage, there would be no debate that these are acts of pedophilia. A man committed what amounts to statutory rape of a 13-year-old girl and basically won't serve any time for it." David Levitt was also dismayed by Green's lenient sentence. "People in the state of Utah," he proclaimed, "simply do not understand and have not understood for 50 years the devastating effect that the practice of polygamy has on young girls in our society." But Levitt went on to say that a change in how polygamy was regarded by Utahns had begun. The ball is rolling. Time will demonstrate that this society will understand that the practice of polygamy is abusive to children, is abusive to women, is abusive to society. Levitt prevailed against Green in court, and he won plaudits from the LDS Church and establishment editorial writers. But like Arizona Governor Howard Pyle, who was voted out of office for masterminding the Short Creek Raid of 1953, Levitt discovered that his anti-polygamy crusade was not popular with the people. In November 2002, the voters of Juab County responded to the conviction of Tom Green by giving the boot to prosecutor David Levitt. Ever since the conviction of the Kingstons, even before Tom Green was first charged with bigamy, Mormon fundamentalists have received support from the American Civil Liberties Union and gay rights activists in advancing their claims of religious persecution. It has been an especially curious and uncomfortable coalition. FLDS doctrine proclaims that sodomy and homosexuality are egregious crimes against God and nature, punishable by death. Yet gays and polygamists have joined forces to keep the government out of the bedroom. This partnership is made even more incongruous by the fact that on the other side of the issue, radical feminists have allied themselves with the resolutely anti-feminist LDS Church to lobby for aggressive prosecution of polygamists. In 1993, LDS Apostle Boyd K. Packer, currently second in line to become president and prophet of the Mormons, pronounced that the church faces 3 major threats: the gay-lesbian movement, the feminist movement, and the ever-present challenge from the so-called scholars or intellectuals. Over the years, the Mormon leadership has made numerous pronouncements about the dangers of the feminist movement and has excommunicated several outspoken feminists. But perhaps the greatest rift between Mormon general authorities and advocates for women's rights occurred when the LDS Church actively and very effectively mobilized Mormons to vote as a bloc against ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, despite the fact that a poll published in the church-owned Deseret News in 1974 showed that 63% of Utahns approved of the ERA. Most political analysts believe that had the LDS Church not taken such an aggressive position against the ERA, it would have been easily ratified by the required 38 states and would now be part of the U.S. Constitution. As they have been forced out of the shadows into the probing glare of the news media, polygamists continue to insist that they are simply trying to live in accordance with their deeply held, constitutionally protected beliefs. "What goes on in our homes here is nobody's business," asserts Sam Roundy, Colorado City's polygamous police chief. "We're not infringing on anybody. Don't we have the right to practice our religion?" But polygamy is a crime in all 50 states, as well as in Canada, and police officers are sworn to uphold the law. This point became problematic for Chief Roundy on February 6, 2002, when Ruth Stubbs, the third wife of one of his police officers, fled Colorado City with her two children and appeared on the evening news in Phoenix, complaining that she had been beaten by her husband, Rodney Holm, and that polygamy is intrinsically abusive. Ruth, 19 when she left home and visibly pregnant with her third child, had been pulled out of school following the sixth grade. Immediately after her 16th birthday, she was summoned to a meeting with Uncle Rulon and his son, Warren Jeffs, who informed her that in 24 hours she would be marrying Officer Holm, a handsome, taciturn man who was exactly twice as old as she was. Ruth had wanted to marry someone else, a boy much closer to her own age. When she balked at becoming Holm's plural wife and asked for some time to consider her options, her older sister Susie Stubbs, one of the two women already married to the police officer, called Ruth an asshole for doing that to Rod. Susie leaned hard on Ruth to become Holm's third wife until Ruth finally caved in and married him. "They told me who to marry," Ruth asserted after she escaped from Colorado City. "I think women should have the right to say yes or no, to have the right to say what's going on in their lives." Not only had Holm broken the law by marrying three women, he had committed statutory rape, a felony in both Utah and Arizona, by having sexual intercourse with Ruth when she was 16. To date, the Colorado City Police Department has not disciplined Officer Holm, who is acting like the aggrieved party in this dispute. Assisted by UEP attorneys, Rodney Holm is presently trying to obtain legal custody of Ruth's children so they can be raised with FLDS values in the company of his other 18 kids. In August 2002, the Utah Attorney General's office charged Holm with felony bigamy and three counts of unlawful sex for his relationship with Ruth. The state's case against Rodney Holm is crippled, however, by a rather significant impediment. In November 2002, Ruth Stubbs disappeared after submitting a signed, handwritten note to the court stating that she did not want Holm to go to jail and refusing to testify against him. As an editorial in the St. George Daily Spectrum noted, "This turn in an already odd case shows how complicated it is to prosecute the members of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who engage in unlawful activities." Before she vanished, Ruth Stubbs was living in the Phoenix home of her aunt, Penny Peterson, who ran away from Colorado City herself at the age of 14 when the prophet commanded her to become the fifth wife of a 48-year-old man. 16 years later, Peterson remains very bitter about the UEP's polygamous culture. "Polygamists say they are being attacked because of their religion," she told the Salt Lake Tribune. "But where in the Constitution does it say that it's okay to molest and impregnate young girls?" The mayor of Colorado City, Dan Barlow, considers apostates like Penny Peterson to be both misinformed and motivated by revenge, and views the prosecution of Rodney Holm as government harassment of an unorthodox but honorable religious minority. To Barlow, the Holm case is disturbingly reminiscent of the 1953 raid on Short Creek. "They're coming after us again," he complains, "and they're even using the same language." But there is a documented pattern of sexual abuse in Colorado City that severely undermines Mayor Barlow's attempt to frame the issue as one of religious persecution. In April 2002, for instance, the mayor's own son and namesake, Dan Barlow Jr., was charged with molesting five of his daughters over a period of many years. The town closed ranks around him, and his father, the mayor, went before the court and pleaded for leniency. In the end, four of the daughters refused to testify against Barlow. He got off with a suspended sentence after agreeing to sign a statement that said, "I made a mistake. I want to make it right. I am so sorry. I want to be a good person. I have raised a good family, been a good father. I love them all, if fatherly love." "Nobody who knows anything about this religion is surprised Dan didn't go to jail," says Debbie Palmer, a former member of the Canadian branch of the religion, barely able to contain her disgust. "Do you have any idea what kind of pressure those poor Barlow girls must have been under not to testify against their father, the mayor's son? I'm sure the prophet told them that if they said one word, they were going straight to hell. When I was abused by prominent members of the religion, that's what I was told every time." Folks in Colorado City pay little heed to such blasphemous talk from the likes of Palmer. They're convinced that Satan, along with nefarious Gentiles and apostates who've fallen under his influence, are wholly to blame for the town's problems. "Satan has been jealous of God since day one," a young, bright-eyed, very devoted member of the priesthood explains after first looking nervously up and down the dry bed of Short Creek, then looking up and down the wash once more to make sure nobody's around to see him talking to a Gentile writer. "Satan wants to rule. He doesn't want God to rule, so he tricks weak people into apostatizing and going over to the other side." This young man, along with most of the other residents of Colorado City, believes that in very short order the world will be thoroughly cleansed of Satan's minions, apostates, mainline Mormons, and Gentile writers alike, because the prophet has told him so many times in the past few years. In the late 1990s, as the new millennium approached, Uncle Rulon assured his followers that they would soon be lifted up to the celestial kingdom, while pestilence, hail, famine, and earthquake would sweep the wicked, i.e. everyone else, from the face of the earth. Fearing that single women would be left behind to perish in the apocalypse because they had not yet been given the opportunity to live the principle, the prophet married off a spate of teenage girls to older, already married men. Ruth Stubbs was one such bride. When the year 2000 came and went without the arrival of Armageddon, or anyone being lifted up, Uncle Rulon explained to his followers that they were to blame, because they hadn't been sufficiently obedient. Contrite, the residents of Colorado City promised to live more righteously. Predicting the end of the world is a win-win situation for Uncle Rulon, apostate Deloy Bateman observes. "You can always just blame it on the iniquities of the people if it doesn't happen, and then use that as a club to hold over their heads and control them in the future." Chapter 3. Bountiful. The essential principle of Mormonism is not polygamy at all, but the ambition of an ecclesiastical hierarchy to wield sovereignty, to rule the souls and lives of its subjects with absolute authority, unrestrained by any civil power. Salt Lake Tribune, February 15, 1885. 900 miles north of Colorado City, just over the Canadian border, the Purcell Mountains rise steeply from the wide, green bottomlands of the Kootenay River. Here, a few miles outside Creston, British Columbia, a cluster of houses and farms stands amid the hayfields, hard beneath the precipitous, thickly forested slopes of Mount Thompson. This bucolic-looking settlement is known as Bountiful. Although its rain-soaked surroundings are a far cry from the desiccated landscape of Colorado City, the two places are inextricably linked. Bountiful is home to some 700 Mormon fundamentalists who belong to the UEP and answer unconditionally to Prophet Rulon Jeffs. Girls from Bountiful are regularly sent south across the international border to be married to men in Colorado City, and even greater numbers of girls from Colorado City are brought north to marry Bountiful men. Debbie Oler Blackmore Ralston Palmer spent most of her life in Bountiful. In 1957, when she was 2 years old, her father, Damon Oler, moved his family to the Creston Valley in order to join a fundamentalist group that had settled there a few years earlier. It was led by a handsome, charismatic man named Ray Blackmore, who had allied the group with the UEP polygamists in Short Creek/Colorado City under Prophet Leroy Johnson. Like many Canadian Mormons, Ray Blackmore was descended from Utah polygamists who had been sent north of the border to continue the doctrine of plural marriage when the LDS Church was forced to renounce polygamy in the United States. By the time Debbie moved to Bountiful, families headed by Eldon Palmer and Sam Ralston, not his real name, had already joined the Blackmore clan and were openly practicing plural marriage. Upon arriving in Bountiful, Debbie's father wasted no time in acquiring his own plurality of wives, eventually marrying 6 women and fathering 45 children, of whom Debbie was the oldest. In an attempt to keep track of so many offspring, her father resorted to giving all the kids born in any given year a name beginning with the same letter. "We called them the A's or the T's or the J's or whatever," he explained on Canadian television. 1976, for example, was the era of the J's. Between June and October of that year, Oler's wives gave birth to Jared, Jeanette, Julia, and Jennifer. Dalman Oler acquired his second wife, Memory Blackmore, just a year after arriving in Bountiful. She was the oldest daughter of Ray Blackmore, and her marriage to Debbie's dad gave Debbie her first inkling that plural marriage wasn't always as wonderful as she had been told. Mother Mem was insecure and terribly jealous, and she beat Debbie when her birth mother wasn't present. When Debbie was 6, her birth mother died, and Mem grew even more violent in her treatment of Debbie, who even as a young girl was proving to be intelligent and willful and disinclined to defer blindly to authority. Debbie tended to ask questions and to think for herself, qualities not regarded as attributes in the fundamentalist church. Until 1986, when Rulon Jeffs assumed leadership of the UEP, the prophet was Leroy Johnson, a plain-spoken farmer known to his followers as Uncle Roy. Many of Johnson's sermons were variations on the theme, "The path to heaven is through total obedience." Today, Uncle Roy's legacy is visible throughout Bountiful, where the community motto, "Keep sweet no matter what," is posted on walls and refrigerator doors in every home. Mormonism is a patriarchal religion rooted firmly in the traditions of the Old Testament. Dissent isn't tolerated. Questioning the edicts of religious authorities is viewed as a subversive act that undermines faith. As the eminent LDS First Counselor N. Eldon Tanner famously declared in the official church magazine Ensign in August 1979, "When the prophet speaks, the debate is over. Men, and only men, are admitted to the priesthood and given positions of ecclesiastical authority, including that of prophet. And only prophets may receive the revelations that determine how the faithful are to conduct their lives, right down to the design of the sacred undergarments individuals are supposed to wear at all times." All of this holds true in both the mainstream LDS church and in the fundamentalist church, although the fundamentalists take these rigid notions of obedience, of control, of distinct and unbending roles for men and women to a much greater extreme. The primary responsibility of women in FLDS communities, even more than in the mainline Mormon culture, is to serve their husbands, conceive as many babies as possible, and raise those children to become obedient members of the religion. More than a few women born into the FLDS church have found this to be problematic. Debbie Palmer is one of them. Tracing a maze-like series of lines with her index finger, Debbie attempts to demystify an incredibly complicated schematic diagram that at first glance appears to map out the intricacies of some massive engineering project. A nuclear power plant, perhaps. Upon closer examination, the diagram turns out to be her family tree. When Debbie was 14, she felt impressed by the Lord to marry Ray Blackmore, the community leader. Debbie asked her father to share her divine impression with Prophet Leroy Johnson, who would periodically travel to Bountiful from Short Creek to perform various religious duties. Because Debbie was lithe and beautiful, Uncle Roy approved of the match. A year later, the prophet returned to Canada and married her to the ailing 57-year-old Blackmore. As his 6th wife, Debbie became a stepmother to Blackmore's 31 kids, most of whom were older than she was. And because he happened to be the father of Debbie's own stepmother, Mem, she unwittingly became a stepmother to her stepmother, and thus a step-grandmother to herself. Following Ray Blackmore's death in 1974, Debbie's father, Dalman Oler, became the leader of Bountiful. He held that position until 1985, when Ray's scheming 29-year-old son, Winston Blackmore, successfully forced him from power, ruined him financially, and very adroitly maneuvered to assume leadership of Bountiful himself. Relying on charm, coercion, and a network of spies that the KGB would have envied, Winston consolidated his power over the ensuing years. He is presently the presiding bishop of the church's Canadian branch, superintendent of the Bountiful Schools, which are funded by the taxpayers of British Columbia, editor of the community newspaper, and manager of all the community's significant business interests. It was, in fact, Winston who christened the community Bountiful. Until he took control, it was called Lister. The control he exerts over the lives of his followers is staggering. Winston has also fathered approximately 100 children at last count, with more than 30 wives. He answers to nobody but God and the prophet in Colorado City. After Winston pushed Debbie's father out of the way, she and Winston became bitter enemies, but they remained tightly bound by a mind-boggling web of family connections. Although Debbie is just a year older than Winston, she is his stepmother. Her oldest daughter is his half-sister. Debbie's actual sister became the first of Winston's numerous wives. One of Debbie's stepchildren is Allaire Blackmore, 7 years older than Debbie, who had been adopted by Ray Blackmore at birth. When Allaire was 18, she was married to Ray, her own adoptive father. Allaire was thus a co-wife to Debbie as well as Debbie's stepdaughter. After Ray died, Allaire was married to Debbie's father. When Winston assumed power, she was taken from Debbie's dad and married to Winston, who was her own brother by adoption. Although these relationships are almost impossible to make sense of without a flowchart, such convoluted permutations are simply business as usual in Bountiful and other polygamist societies. For all their fecundity, Mormon fundamentalists are strangely squeamish about sex. Boys and girls are forbidden to date or even flirt before marriage. Sex education consists of teaching children that the human body is a shameful vessel that should be veiled from the eyes of others at all times. "We were told to treat each other like snakes," explains one of Debbie's sons. "Women and girls are required to wear long dresses, even while swimming. Boys and men wear long pants and long-sleeved shirts. Both genders must wear sacred long underwear beneath their clothing at all times, even on sweltering summer days. According to the law of chastity, sexual intercourse is officially forbidden even between husband and wife, unless the woman is ovulating." Gravel crunching beneath its tires, Debbie's car rounds a bend, and the house where she grew up suddenly comes into view, moldering at the edge of a soggy hillside bearded in ferns and evergreen forest. It's been many years since she's been back here. "See where that car is parked off to the side there?" Debbie says, pointing to an old vehicle rusting beneath a graceful canopy of red cedars. "When I was 6, that's where Rennie Blackmore, not his real name, took me. Said he was going to teach me how to drive." Instead of giving Debbie a driving lesson, Rennie, one of Winston's teenage brothers, sexually assaulted her. "Yuck," she recalls, grimacing. "Thinking about what he did to me in that car still gives me a creepy feeling." In spite of, or more likely precisely because of, the atmosphere of sexual repression in Bountiful, incest and other disturbing behaviors are rampant, although the abuse goes conspicuously unacknowledged. Debbie remembers older boys taking girls as young as 4 into a big white barn behind the school to play cows and bulls among the hay bales. A boy who would grow up to become a prominent member of the church leadership raped one of Debbie's friends when he was 12 and the girl was 7. When Debbie was 4, she says, Winston's 14-year-old brother, Andrew Blackmore, not his real name, jammed a stick up my vagina and left it in there for a while, telling me to lie very still and not to move. Before Debbie's father died in 1998, he built a much larger second home just above the modest building where Debbie was raised. a barn-like white clapboard house with 14 bathrooms and 15 bedrooms where some 50 people reside. These days the household is presided over by Memory Blackmore, Mother Mem, and her 41-year-old son Jimmy Oler, Debbie's half-brother. Neither of them is home at the moment, but a half-dozen teenage girls are juggling babies on their hips in the huge downstairs living room. They are the wives of Jimmy and some of the other bountiful men. Among these girls is a giggling, gap-toothed kid who looks like she belongs in elementary school, but happens to be immensely pregnant. At the top of the stairs is a long hallway plastered with snapshots of Debbie's extended family. Debbie herself appears in several of the photos. One of them shows her as a smiling teenager in a pink, frilly, ankle-length dress. It was taken at her wedding to Ray Blackmore when she was only a year older than the pregnant 14-year-old downstairs. Debbie's new husband, standing beside her in the picture, is a wizened, gray-haired man, almost four times as old as she is. "I got pregnant soon after that," she says, "but I miscarried the baby. I was told it was because I had violated the law of chastity by having sex during my pregnancy. Ray blamed me for it and made me feel wicked." This double bind left Debbie reeling. "Ray would almost never talk to me," she says. "He would ignore me for days on end. The only time he paid attention to me was when we had sex. It got so if I didn't have a penis in me, I didn't think I was loved. I was just a child when I was forced to deal with all of this. I was made to feel like a whore, a person with no worth beyond my vagina and my womb. Around town, I became the butt of mean jokes." Ray Blackmore died of leukemia in 1974 after 19-year-old Debbie had been married to him for a little over 3 years and had given birth to his daughter. Soon thereafter, Debbie was ordered against her wishes to marry Sam Ralston, one of Bountiful's founding patriarchs, a violent 54-year-old sociopath who already had four wives. After giving birth to two of Ralston's children and enduring years of cruelty at his hands, she became desperate enough to run away to the only refuge she could think of, her father's home. The next time Prophet Leroy Johnson, Uncle Roy, was in Canada, however, he commanded Debbie to return to Sam Ralston. "I begged him not to make me do it," she said, "but he told me that when they married me to Sam, they did it because they hoped it would encourage him in the priesthood and help him feel better toward my father." I was shocked, realizing for the first time that my marriage to Sam was something the men wanted me to do, not God. Debbie dutifully returned to Ralston, whereupon he told her, she says, that I was an evil woman and he would make me pay for my wickedness. Debbie grew depressed and increasingly self-destructive. Her father became so alarmed by her deteriorating condition that he clandestinely rescued Debbie and her children from Ralston's home, installed them in his own household, and convinced Uncle Roy to release her from the marriage. But the failure of her second marriage reinforced the opinion in Bountiful that she was a dull-witted, disobedient nuisance, more trouble to the community than she was worth. "I began taking pills," she says. "Lots of pills. Sleeping pills, painkillers, tranquilizers." When Debbie sought solace from her father, he simply quoted scripture, telling her, "You must have a broken heart and a contrite spirit to know God." In 1980, one night not long after this bit of advice, she was weeping and semi-comatose from her medications when her father came into her bedroom and began to comfort her. Soon, however, she became dimly aware, through the narcotic fog, that his ministrations had become something more. He was engaging in sexual intercourse with her. She remained passive and made no effort to stop him. Later, she wondered guiltily if she had somehow encouraged his incestuous attentions. In the months that followed, Debbie tried to drown herself in the Goat River, a fast mountain stream that flows past Bountiful, but she failed at that as well. After she attempted suicide once more, this time with an overdose of sedatives, she was committed to the psychiatric ward of a nearby hospital. While she was recovering, an acquaintance named Michael Palmer, not his real name, came to visit her in the hospital. Palmer, a 38-year-old long-haul trucker married to two of Winston Blackmore's sisters, was part of the religion but worked outside of Bountiful. Debbie recalls that during his visit, Palmer touched me and kissed me. He made me feel beautiful. When she was released from the hospital, though, the community still thought of her as a difficult, uncontrollable woman, and nobody was sure what should be done with her. Uncle Roy, who was by then 93 years old, very ill, and fast fading into senility, came to Canada and asked Debbie if there were any men that she liked. Michael Palmer, she replied. So the prophet told Michael to marry me, she explains. I became Michael's third wife. At first, life with Michael was wonderful. He held me and helped me throw away my pills. When I had my first baby girl by Michael, he was happy and actually played with the baby. He encouraged me to have ideas. I loved him. The marriage was not without difficulties, however. The two women already married to Michael, Marlena and Michelle Blackmore, who happened to be Debbie's stepdaughters, were intensely jealous of each other, and Debbie's installation in their home as a new sister wife only added to their misery. Sharing Michael proved especially difficult for Michelle, his first wife. On the nights when it was Michael's turn to sleep with Debbie, Michelle would listen from the room directly below, alternately crying hysterically and straining to hear sounds of passion that would prove to her that Michael preferred Debbie. I found Michelle this way one night when Michael and I had just finished making love, and I went downstairs to check on the children, says Debbie. When I saw her, I felt like we were trapped in the middle of a nightmare. I felt violated, but the shame and agony I saw on her face made it impossible for me to even say anything. At one point, Michelle discovered that Michael had had intercourse with Debbie when she was pregnant, a serious violation of the law of chastity. Debbie remembers being confronted afterward by Michelle, her face black with rage and pain, spitting out her venomous jealousy. You are a harlot and a whore, and because you tempted Michael to have sex with you while you were pregnant, he is an adulterer, and my chance to be exalted is gone. I'm going to tell Winston, and you're going to be in big trouble. Michelle did, and Debbie was. In 1986, Uncle Roy died, and Rulon Jeffs became the UEP's new prophet. In the climate of upheaval that followed, there was turmoil in both Bountiful and Colorado City. Because Michael worked outside of the community among Gentiles, he fell out of favor and was secretly voted out of the priesthood. He was crushed when he learned of his rejection, and the disappointment triggered a latent instability in his personality. Michael became emotionally withdrawn and angry. He sexually molested one of Debbie's sons, as well as another boy outside of the family. On October 27, 1986, Debbie's daughter Sharon was lying in bed with a high fever. Michael went into her bedroom, Debbie says, and began wiping her face with a cold cloth. Then he took the nightgown off her 13-year-old body and washed first her back, then her breasts. When she asked him to stop, he acted like he didn't hear her and kept doing it. He washed her over and over and then put the nightgown back on her and put her between his legs on the carpet and continued to massage her breasts and scalp. After blurting out to her mother what Michael had done, Sharon cried uncontrollably for weeks. She told Debbie that she was terrified she would have to marry Michael because some of her friends in Colorado City had had to marry their stepfathers after being molested by them. In December 1987, Winston ordered Sharon, who was his half-sister, to move out of Debbie's house and move in with him. When Debbie learned of this, she says, I went wild. I'd seen him take so many women's children away from them, and I wasn't going to let him take Sharon. I went straight down to Winston's house and confronted him. He was in bed. I stormed into his bedroom and started screaming that there was no way he was going to get Sharon. Debbie vividly remembers the reaction this provoked in Winston, who was unaccustomed to having a woman disobey him. He issued a clear, unmistakable threat, she says. This cold look came into Winston's eyes, and he told me, you might want to be careful. I've got at least six boys who will rearrange your face if I just give them the word. Debbie stood her ground. Sharon will come here and live with you, she vowed, only over my dead body. And then she walked out and went home. By this point, Winston had moved Michelle and Marlena out of Michael's house and was haranguing Debbie to vacate the premises as well so that he could take possession of it. Every single day, Winston would come to the door and yell at me, Debbie remembers. He'd shout, "You have to leave! You have to leave now!" But I didn't have anywhere to go, except my dad's house, and I couldn't go back there. Not after what had happened with him. Mustering her mulish resolve, each time Winston showed up, Debbie would let him rant, then silently wait for him to leave. She refused to move out. Her obstinacy enraged him. Alone in Michael's big house with her kids, Debbie thought about women who had summoned the courage to leave Bountiful. On many occasions over the years, Winston, Uncle Roy, and Uncle Rulon had warned that those foolish enough to forsake the religion would be cast into utter darkness and ground into native element. They would end up walking the streets as whores, selling their bodies to dirty Gentiles, damned until the end of time. Debbie had never doubted that this was exactly what happened to all those who left Bountiful and abandoned the faith. More and more, however, the behavior of some of her brethren within the religion struck her as anything but righteous. Debbie was finding it increasingly difficult to believe that God made his will known through the commandments of self-proclaimed prophets like the leaders of the UEP. She discovered herself trying to unravel where God stops and men begin. The prospect of abandoning everything she believed to be true about the world and her place in it was a terrifying intellectual leap to make, she says. But I knew I must take responsibility for my life and my children, and quit pretending that God ever had anything to do with the pain I was in. Debbie spent the day of February 7th, 1988, cleaning the house with obsessive thoroughness. It was Sunday. She put a turkey in the oven to bake. A strange feeling came over her like she was walking around in a dream. It was a frigid, foggy day with snow blanketing the ground, but she didn't notice the cold. "I got the kids all to bed really early," she remembers. On some level, I guess I knew what I was about to do just before I put the kids to bed. I suddenly realized everything is ready now. The house is perfect. I chopped a big pile of cedar kindling, put it in a corner cupboard with some fire paper, and put a match to it. Then I went into my bedroom at the other end of the house and shut the door. I got out the photo albums that told the story of my life. I sat on the bed and looked at them for a long time, then put them back on the shelf. And then I sat down to wait. I thought about the kids. I tried thinking about leaving Bountiful and moving to Calgary and trying to make it on my own, but it made my head hurt too much. It was a blinding pain. I couldn't think about it. I just stayed in my room with the door shut until I could hear the crackling of the flames. At that point, I walked to the bedroom door and opened it without really even being conscious of doing it. Down the long hallway, the kitchen was alive with licking, twisting flames dancing across the ceiling toward me. I knew then that I had to get the children out. As I ran downstairs to wake them, I could feel my heart throbbing in my ears. After Debbie ushered all the children outside, Winston arrived and drove them all down the hill to his own house. A policeman from Creston came over and asked Debbie how the fire had started. "I was cooking a turkey in the oven," she lied convincingly, "and must have forgotten to turn it off." This seemed to satisfy him, and after a few minutes he left. Debbie found herself alone in Winston's kitchen. After a while, she went back out into the raw night and walked up the hill to where her home was burning. "The firemen were there by then," she says, "running all over the place. Suddenly, they all came pouring out of the house, yelling that it was at flashpoint. A second later, the whole thing exploded in flames and all the windows blew out. I stood a short distance away in a field next to a barbed wire fence, watching the flames roar against the mountains behind, swaying and shaking uncontrollably. After a while, I realized that the men had stopped spraying water on the fire and were leaving, so I turned to leave myself. When I uncurled my fingers from the fence, my hand was damp with blood. I had been holding tightly onto a strand of barbed wire, and it had cut deep into my hand, but I hadn't felt a thing. Burning down her house was a desperate act, but it served as the instrument of her emancipation. Not long after the embers had cooled, Debbie loaded her five children and a few garbage bags holding all their worldly belongings into a rust-ravaged car. Then she drove out of Bountiful and steered the vehicle east over the snow-choked Rocky Mountains, determined to create a new life for her family and herself, Beyond the Grasp of Winston, Uncle Rulon, and the UEP. Chapter 4. Elizabeth and Ruby. But then I sigh, and with a piece of scripture tell them that God bids us do good for evil. And thus I clothe my naked villainy with odd old ends stolen forth of holy writ, and seem a saint when most I play the devil. William Shakespeare, Richard III. On June 5th, 2002, 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart was abducted at knife point from her Salt Lake City bedroom in the middle of the night while her parents slept in a nearby part of the house. Details of the audacious kidnapping were reported breathlessly and without pause by the news media, leaving much of the country aghast and riveted. When a massive investigation failed to locate Elizabeth or her unidentified abductor by summer's end, people assumed the worst, that she had been subjected to some unspeakable ordeal and murdered. Then, 9 months after she disappeared, she turned up alive, surprising almost everyone. The astonishing reappearance of Elizabeth Smart occurred in the jittery days immediately before the invasion of Iraq. Most Americans, made fretful by the uncertainties of the imminent war, were desperate for some good news and rejoiced with commensurate intensity when the girl was reunited with her family. President George W. Bush took time out from planning the assault on Baghdad to phone Elizabeth's father and convey the nation's collective jubilation over her safe return. Ed Smart, brimming with emotion, called the outcome a miracle. "God lives," he declared. "The prayers of the world have brought Elizabeth home." Like so many other Americans, Dan Lafferty found himself spellbound by the Elizabeth Smart saga, monitoring its heart-rending convolutions via a small television in his cell at the Utah State Prison. Within hours of the girl's rescue, the media disclosed that her abductor was an excommunicated Mormon. "With that small piece of information," boasts Lafferty, "I immediately guessed that he was probably a fundamentalist and that Elizabeth was somehow involved in a polygamy situation." Lafferty was soon proven correct. The man who kidnapped Elizabeth turned out to be a 49-year-old Utah named Brian David Mitchell. Although he was indeed a Mormon fundamentalist, he was not affiliated with the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the faction that holds sway in Bountiful and Colorado City, Hilldale, or any other established sect. He was a so-called independent, of whom there are untold multitudes currently practicing polygamy throughout the western United States, Canada, and Mexico. Thanks to the torrent of publicity generated by his 2001 trial and imprisonment, polygamist Tom Green had been the most widely recognized independent fundamentalist. But that was before Mitchell was arrested for kidnapping Elizabeth Smart and became a fixture in the news. Mitchell was not born into fundamentalism. He'd spent most of his life as a dutiful Latter-day Saint, and for 3 years he'd actually worked at the Salt Lake Temple, the epicenter of the establishment church, where he performed in ritual reenactments of sacred history. His wife, Wanda Barzee, was an upstanding saint as well, who for a period had played organ at the Mormon Tabernacle. One of Barzee's music teachers described the couple as the epitome of righteousness, fulfilling every church duty and assignment. Mitchell's unflagging zeal raised eyebrows even then, however. During his tenure as a temple worker, his job was to act the part of Satan in staged religious dramas. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, Mitchell was so convincing in the role that he made church officials uneasy. Inevitably, his religious ardor brought him in contact with the fundamentalist fringe, which has a ubiquitous, if shadowy, presence up and down the Wasatch Front. By the mid-1990s, Mitchell had grown firm in his conviction that the church leaders had erred ruinously more than a century before when they'd let the federal government force them to renounce polygamy. He and Barzee embraced Mormon fundamentalism as passionately as they'd previously embraced mainstream Mormonism and were officially cast out of the LDS Church. On Thanksgiving Day 2000, Mitchell announced to Barzee and anyone else who would listen that he had received a revelation in which the Lord commanded him to take 7 additional wives. Subsequent divine commandments revealed that Mitchell's name was actually Emmanuel David Isaiah, and that he had been placed on earth to serve as a mouthpiece for the Lord during the last days. Mitchell stopped shaving and cutting his hair, dressed in billowing robes fashioned after the garb of Old Testament prophets, and gained a reputation throughout the Salt Lake Valley as an eccentric but harmless street preacher. He often introduced himself as God Be With Us, and Barzee as God Adorn Us. A year after determining that God wanted him to marry a plurality of women, Mitchell crossed paths with a wealthy Mormon housewife named Lois Smart outside a downtown shopping mall.